To Kill a Mockingbird, Part 1, Chapter 2. Dill left us early in September to return to Meridian. We saw him off on the 5 o'clock bus, and I was miserable without him until it occurred to me that I would be starting school in a week. I never looked forward more to anything in my life. Hours of wintertime had found me in the treehouse, looking over at the schoolyard, spying on multitudes of children through a 2-power telescope Jim had given me, learning their games, following Jim's red jacket through wriggling circles of blind men's buff, secretly sharing their misfortunes and minor victories. I longed to join them. Jim condescended to take me to school the first day, a job usually done by one's parents, but Atticus had said Jim would be delighted to show me where my room was. I think some money changed hands in this transaction, for as we trotted around the corner past the Radley place, I heard an unfamiliar jingle in Jim's pockets. When we slowed to a walk at the edge of the schoolyard, Jim was careful to explain that during school hours, I was not to bother him. I was not to approach him with requests to enact a chapter of Tarzan and the Ant-Men, to embarrass him with references to his private life, or tag along behind him at recess and noon. I was to stick with the first grade, and he would stick with the fifth. In short, I was to leave him alone. "You mean we can't play anymore?" I asked. "We'll do like we always do at home," he said, "but you'll see, school's different." It certainly was. Before the first morning was over, Miss Caroline Fisher, our teacher, hauled me up to the front of the room and patted the palm of my hand with the ruler, then made me stand in the corner until noon. Miss Caroline was no more than 21. She had bright auburn hair, pink cheeks, and wore crimson fingernail polish. She also wore high-heeled pumps and a red and white striped dress. She looked and smelled like a peppermint drop. She boarded across the street, one door down from us, in Miss Maudie Atkinson's upstairs front room. And when Miss Maudie introduced us to her, Jim was in a haze for days. Miss Caroline printed her name on the blackboard and said, "This says I am Miss Caroline Fisher. I am from North Alabama, from Winston County." The class murmured apprehensively. Should she prove to harbor her share of the peculiarities indigenous to that region? When Alabama seceded from the Union on January 11, 1861, Winston County seceded from Alabama, and every child in Macomb County knew it. North Alabama was full of liquor interest, big mules, steel companies, Republicans, professors, and other persons of no background. Miss Caroline began the day by reading us a story about cats. The cats had long conversations with one another. They wore cunning little clothes and lived in a warm house beneath the kitchen stove. By the time Mrs. Cat called the drugstore for an order of chocolate malted mice, the class was wriggling like a bucket full of cataworms. Miss Caroline seemed unaware that the ragged denim shirted and flour sack skirted first grade, most of whom had chopped cotton and fed hogs from the time they were able to walk, were immune to imaginative literature. Miss Caroline came to the end of the story and said, "Oh my, wasn't that nice?" Then she went to the blackboard and printed the alphabet in enormous square capitals, turned to the class and asked, "Does anybody know what these are?" Everybody did. Most of the first grade had failed it last year. I suppose she chose me because she knew my name. As I read the alphabet, a faint line appeared between her eyebrows. And, after making me read most of my first reader and the stock market quotations from the mobile register aloud, she discovered that I was literate and looked at me with more than faint distaste. Miss Caroline told me to tell my father not to teach me anymore. It would interfere with my reading. "Teach me?" I asked in surprise. "He hasn't taught me anything, Miss Caroline. Atticus ain't got time to teach me anything," I added. When Miss Caroline smiled and shook her head, "Why, he's so tired at night, he just sits in the living room and reads." "If he didn't teach you, who did?" Miss Caroline asked good-naturedly. "Somebody did. You weren't born reading the mobile register." "Jim says I was. He read in a book where I was a bullfinch instead of a finch. Jim says my name's really Jean Louise Bullfinch, that I got swapped when I was born, and I'm really a..." Miss Caroline apparently thought I was lying. "Let's not let our imaginations run away with us, dear," she said. "Now you tell your father not to teach you anymore. It's best to begin reading with a fresh mind. You tell him I'll take over from here and try to undo the damage." "Ma'am?" "Your father does not know how to teach. You can have a seat now." I mumbled that I was sorry and retired meditating upon my crime. I never deliberately learned to read, but somehow I had been wallowing illicitly in the daily papers and the long hours of church. Was it then I learned? I could not remember not being able to read hymns. Now that I was compelled to think about it, reading was something that just came to me as learning to fasten the seat of my union suit without looking around or achieving two bows from a snarl of shoelaces. I could not remember when the lines above Atticus's moving finger separated into words, but I had stared at them all the evenings in my memory, listening to the news of the day. Bills to be enacted into laws, the diaries of Lorenzo Dow, anything Atticus happened to be reading when I crawled into his lap every night. Until I feared I would lose it, I never loved to read. One does not love breathing. I knew I had annoyed Miss Caroline, so I let well enough alone and stared out the window until recess, when Jim cut me from the convoy of first graders in the schoolyard. He asked how I was getting along, and I told him. If I didn't have to stay, I'd leave. Jim, that damn lady says Atticus has been teaching me to read and for him to stop it. Don't worry, Scout, Jim comforted me. Our teacher says Miss Caroline's introducing a new way of teaching. She learned about it in college. It'll be in all the grades soon. You don't have to learn much out of books that way. It's like if you want to learn about cows, you go milk one, see? Yeah, Jim, but I don't want to study cows. Sure you do. You have to know about cows. They're a big part of life in Macomb County. I contented myself with asking Jim if he'd lost his mind. I'm just trying to tell you the new way they're teaching the first grade, stubborn. It's the Dewey Decimal System. Having never questioned Jim's pronouncements, I saw no reason to begin now. The Dewey Decimal System consisted, in part, of Miss Caroline waving cards at us on which were printed the, cat, rat, man, and you. No comment seemed to be expected of us as the class received these impressionistic revelations in silence. I was bored, so I began a letter to Dill. Miss Caroline caught me writing and told me to tell my father to stop teaching me. Besides, she said, we don't write in the first grade, we print. You won't learn to write until you're in third grade. Calpurnia was to blame for this. It kept me from driving her crazy on rainy days, I guess. She would set me a writing task by scrawling the alphabet firmly across the top of a tablet, then copying out a chapter of the Bible beneath. If I reproduced her penmanship satisfactorily, she rewarded me with an open-faced sandwich of bread and butter and sugar. In Calpurnia's teaching, there was no sentimentality. I seldom pleased her, and she seldom rewarded me. "Everybody who goes home to lunch, hold up your hand," said Miss Caroline, breaking into my new grudge against Calpurnia. The town children did so, and she looked us over. "Everybody who brings his lunch, put it on top of his desk." Molasses buckets appeared from nowhere, and the ceiling danced with metallic light. Miss Caroline walked up and down the rows, peering and poking into lunch containers, nodding if the contents pleased her, frowning a little at others. She stopped at Walter Cunningham's desk. "Where's yours?" she asked. Walter Cunningham's face told everybody in the first grade he had hookworms. His absence of shoes told us how he got them. People caught hookworms going barefooted in barnyards and hog wallows. If Walter had owned any shoes, he would have worn them the first day of school and then discarded them until midwinter. He didn't have on a clean shirt and neatly mended overalls. "Did you forget your lunch this morning?" asked Miss Caroline. Walter looked straight ahead. I saw a muscle jump in his skinny jaw. "Did you forget it this morning?" asked Miss Caroline. Walter's jaw twitched again. "Yep," he finally mumbled. Miss Caroline went to her desk and opened her purse. "Here's a quarter," she said to Walter. "Go and eat downtown today. You can pay me back tomorrow." Walter shook his head. No, thank you, ma'am, he drawled softly. Impatience crept into Miss Caroline's voice. "Here, Walter, come and get it." Walter shook his head again. When Walter shook his head a third time, someone whispered, "Go on and tell her, Scout." I turned around and saw most of the town people and the entire bus delegation looking at me. Miss Caroline and I had conferred twice already, and they were looking at me in the innocent assurance that familiarity breeds understanding. I rose graciously on Walter's behalf. Miss Caroline? What is it, Jean Louise? Miss Caroline, he's a Cunningham. I sat back down. What, Jean Louise? I thought I had made things sufficiently clear. It was clear enough to the rest of us. Walter Cunningham was sitting there lying his head off. He didn't forget his lunch. He didn't have any. He had none today, nor would he have any tomorrow or the next day. He had probably never seen three quarters together at the same time in his life. I tried again. Walter's one of the Cunninghams, Miss Caroline. I beg your pardon, Jean Louise? That's okay, ma'am. You'll get to know all the county folks after a while. The Cunninghams never took anything they can't pay back. No church baskets and no scrip stamps. They never took anything off anybody. They get along on what they have. They don't have much, but they get along on it. My special knowledge of the Cunningham tribe, one branch that is, was gained from events of last winter. Walter's father was one of Atticus's clients. After a dreary conversation in our living room one night about his entailment, before Mr. Cunningham left, he said, "Mr. Finch, I don't know when I'll ever be able to pay you." "Let that be the least of your worries, Walter," Atticus said. When I asked Jim what entailment was, and Jim described it as a condition of having your tail in a crack, I asked Atticus if Mr. Cunningham would ever pay us. "Not in money," Atticus said, "but before the year's out, I'll have been paid. You watch." We watched. One morning, Jim and I found a load of stove wood in the backyard. Later, a sack of hickory nuts appeared on the back steps. With Christmas came a crate of smilax and holly. That spring, when we found a croaker sack full of turnip greens, Atticus said Mr. Cunningham had more than paid him. "Why does he pay you like that?" I asked. "Because that's the only way he can pay me. He has no money." "Are we poor, Atticus?" Atticus nodded. "We are indeed." Jim's nose wrinkled. "Are we as poor as the Cunninghams?" "Not exactly. The Cunninghams are country folk, farmers, and the crash hit them hardest." Atticus said professional people were poor because the farmers were poor. As Macomb County was farm county, nickels and dimes were hard to come by for doctors and dentists and lawyers. Entailment was only a part of Mr. Cunningham's vexations. The acres not entailed were mortgaged to the hilt, and the little cash he made went to interest. If he held his mouth right, Mr. Cunningham could get a WPA job, but his land would go to ruin if he left it, and he was willing to go hungry to keep his land and vote as he pleased. Mr. Cunningham said Atticus came from a set breed of men. As the Cunninghams had no money to pay a lawyer, they simply paid us with what they had. "Did you know," said Atticus, "that Dr. Reynolds works the same way? He charges some folks a bushel of potatoes for delivery of a baby. Miss Scout, if you give me your attention, I'll tell you what entailment is. Jim's definitions are very nearly accurate sometimes." If I could have explained these things to Miss Caroline, I would have saved myself some inconvenience and Miss Caroline's subsequent mortification. But it was beyond my ability to explain things as well as Atticus, so I said, "You're shaming him, Miss Caroline. Walter hasn't got a quarter at home to bring you, and you can't use any stove wood." Miss Caroline stood stock still, then grabbed me by the collar and hauled me back to her desk. "Jean Louise, I've had about enough of you this morning," she said. "You're starting off on the wrong foot in every way, my dear. Hold out your hand." I thought she was going to spit in it, which was the only reason anybody in Macomb held out his hand. It was a time-honored method of sealing oral contracts. Wondering what bargain we had made, I turned to the class for an answer, but the class looked back at me in puzzlement. Miss Caroline picked up her ruler, gave me a half dozen quick little pats, then told me to stand in the corner. A storm of laughter broke loose when it finally occurred to the class that Miss Caroline had whipped me. When Miss Caroline threatened it with a similar fate, the first grade class exploded again, becoming cold sober only when the shadow of Miss Blount fell over them. Miss Blount, a native Macombian, as yet uninitiated in the mysteries of the decimal system, appeared at the door, hands on her hips, and announced, "If I hear another sound from this room, I'll burn up everybody in it. Miss Caroline, the sixth grade cannot concentrate on the pyramids for all this racket." My sojourn in the corner was a short one. Saved by the bell, Miss Caroline watched the class file out for lunch. As I was the last to leave, I saw her sink down into her chair and bury her head in her arms. Had her conduct been more friendly toward me, I would have felt sorry for her. She was a pretty little thing. Chapter 3. Catching Walter Cunningham in the schoolyard gave me some pleasure, but when I was rubbing his nose in the dirt, Jim came by and told me to stop. You're bigger'n he is, he said. He's as old as you, nearly, I said. He made me start off on the wrong foot. Let him go, Scout. Why? He didn't have any lunch, I said, and explained my involvement in Walter's dietary affairs. Walter had picked himself up and was standing quietly listening to Jim and me. His fists were half-cocked, as if expecting an onslaught from both of us. I stomped at him to chase him away, but Jim put out his hand and stopped me. He examined Walter with an air of speculation. "Your daddy, Mr. Walter Cunningham, from Old Sarum?" he asked, and Walter nodded. Walter looked as if he had been raised on fish food. His eyes, as blue as Dill Harris's, were red-rimmed and watery. There was no color in his face except at the tip of his nose, which was moistly pink. He fingered the straps of his overalls, nervously picking at the metal hooks. Jim suddenly grinned at him. "Come on home to dinner with us, Walter," he said. "We'd be glad to have you." Walter's face brightened, then darkened. Jim said, "Our daddy's a friend of your daddy's. Scout here, she's crazy. She won't fight you anymore." "I wouldn't be too certain of that," I said. Jim's free dispensation of my pledge irked me. But precious noontime minutes were ticking away. "Yeah, Walter, I won't jump on you again. Don't you like butter beans? Our Cal's a real good cook." Walter stood where he was, biting his lip. Jim and I gave up, and we were nearly to the Radley place when Walter called, "Hey, I'm coming!" When Walter caught up with us, Jim made a pleasant conversation with him. "I hain't lives there," he said, quarterly pointing to the Radley house. "Ever hear about him, Walter?" "Reckon I have," said Walter. "Almost died first year I come to school and eat them pecans. Folks say he poisoned them and put them over on the school side of the fence." Jim seemed to have little fear of Boo Radley now that Walter and I walked beside him. Indeed, Jim grew boastful. "I went all the way up to the house once," he said to Walter. "Anybody who went up to the house once ought to not to still run every time he passes it," I said to the clouds above. "And who's running, Miss Pris? You are when ain't anybody with you." By the time we reached our front steps, Walter had forgotten he was a Cunningham. Jim ran to the kitchen and asked Calpurnia to set an extra plate. We had company. Atticus greeted Walter and began a discussion about crops neither Jim nor I could follow. "Reason I can't pass first grade, Mr. Finch, is I've had to stay out every spring and help Papa with the chopping. But there's another at the house now. That's field size." "Did you pay a bushel of potatoes for him?" I asked. But Atticus shook his head at me. While Walter piled food on his plate, he and Atticus talked together like two men, to the wonderment of Jim and me. Atticus was expounding upon farm problems when Walter interrupted to ask if there was any molasses in the house. Atticus summoned Calpurnia, who returned bearing the syrup pitcher. She stood waiting for Walter to help himself. Walter poured syrup on his vegetables and meat with a generous hand. He would probably have poured it into his milk glass had I not asked what the Sam Hill he was doing. The silver saucer clattered when he replaced the pitcher, and he quickly put his hands in his lap. Then he ducked his head. Atticus shook his head at me again. "But he's gone and drowned his dinner in syrup," I protested. "He's poured it all over..." It was then that Calpurnia requested my presence in the kitchen. She was furious, and when she was furious, Calpurnia's grammar became erratic. When in tranquility, her grammar was as good as anybody's in Maycomb. Atticus said Calpurnia had more education than most colored folks. When she squinted down at me, the tiny lines around her eyes deepened. "There's some folks who don't eat like us," she whispered fiercely. "But you ain't called on to contradict them at the table when they don't. That boy's your company. If he wants to eat up the tablecloth, you let him. You hear?" "He ain't company, Cal. He's just a Cunningham." "Hush your mouth. Don't matter who they are. Anybody sets foot in this house, your company. And don't you let me catching you remarking on their ways like you was so high and mighty. Your folks might be better than the Cunninghams, but it don't count for nothing the way you're disgracing them. And if you can't act fit to eat at the table, you can just sit here and eat in the kitchen." Calpurnia sent me through the swinging door to the dining room with a stinging smack. I retrieved my plate and finished dinner in the kitchen, thankful, though, that I was spared the humiliation of facing them again. I told Calpurnia to just wait. I'd fix her. One of these days, when she wasn't looking, I'd go off and drown myself in Barker's Eddy, and then she'd be sorry. Besides, I added, she'd already gotten me in trouble once today. She had taught me to write, and it was all her fault. "Hush your fussin'," she said. Jim and Walter returned to school ahead of me, staying behind to advise Atticus of Calpurnia's iniquities was worth a solitary sprint past the Radley place. She likes Jim better than she likes me anyway, I concluded, and suggested that Atticus lose no time in packing her off. Have you considered that Jim doesn't worry her half as much? Atticus Foyt was flinty. I've no intention of getting rid of her, now or ever. We couldn't operate a single day without Cal. Have you ever thought of that? You think about how much Cal does for you, and you mind her, you hear? I returned to school and hated Calpurnia steadily until a sudden shriek shattered my resentments. I looked up to see Miss Caroline standing in the middle of the room, sheer horror flooding her face. Apparently, she had revived enough to persevere in her profession. "It's alive!" she screamed. The male population of the class rushed at once to her assistance. Lord, I thought, she's scared of a mouse. Little Chuck Little, whose patience with all living things was phenomenal, said, "Which way did he go, Miss Caroline? Tell us where he went. Quick, D.C.," he turned to a boy behind him. "D.C., shut the door and we'll catch him. Quick, ma'am, where'd he go?" Miss Caroline pointed a shaking finger, not at the floor nor at a desk, but to a hulking individual unknown to me. Little Chuck's face contracted as he said gently, "You mean him, ma'am?" "Yes'm. He's alive. Did he scare you some way?" Miss Caroline said desperately, "I was just walking by when it crawled out of his hair. Just crawled out of his hair." Little Chuck grinned broadly. "There ain't no need to fear a cootie, ma'am. Ain't you never seen one? Now don't you be afraid. You just go back to your desk and teach us some more." Little Chuck Little was another member of the population who didn't know where his next meal was coming from, but he was a born gentleman. He put his hand under his elbow and led Miss Caroline to the front of the room. "Now don't you fret, ma'am," he said. "There ain't no need to fear a cootie. I'll just fetch you some cool water." The cootie's host showed not the faintest interest in the furor he had wrought. He searched the scalp above his forehead, located his guest, and pinched it between his thumb and forefinger. Miss Caroline watched the process in horrid fascination. Little Chuck brought water in a paper cup, and she drank it gratefully. Finally, she found her voice. "What is your name, son?" she asked softly. The boy blinked. "Who, me?" Miss Caroline nodded. "Burris Ewell." Miss Caroline inspected her roll book. "I have a Ewell here, but I don't have a first name. Would you spell your first name?" "Don't know how. They call me Burris at home." "Well, Burris," said Miss Caroline, "I think we better excuse you for the rest of the afternoon. I want you to go home and wash your hair." From her desk, she produced a thick volume, leafed through its pages, and read for a moment. "A good home remedy for Burris. I want you to go home and wash your hair with lye soap. When you've done that, treat your scalp with kerosene."
"What for, missus?"
"To get rid of the cooties. You see, Burris, the other children might catch them, and you wouldn't want that, would you?" The boy stood up. He was the filthiest human I had ever seen. His neck was dark gray, the back of his hands were rusty, and his fingernails were black deep into the quick. He peered at Miss Caroline from a fist-sized clean space on his face. No one had noticed him, probably because Miss Caroline and I had entertained the class most of the morning. "And Burris," said Miss Caroline, "please bathe yourself before you come back tomorrow." The boy laughed rudely. "You ain't sending me home, missus. I was on the verge of leaving. I'd done my time for this year." Miss Caroline looked puzzled. "What do you mean by that?" The boy did not answer. He gave a short, contemptuous snort. One of the elderly members of the class answered, "He's one of the Ewells, ma'am." And I wondered if this explanation would be as unsuccessful as my attempt. But Miss Caroline seemed willing to listen. "Whole school's full of them. They come the first day every year and then leave. The truant lady gets them here because she threatens them with the sheriff, but she's give up trying to hold them. She reckons she's carried out the law just getting their names on the roll and running them here the first day. You're supposed to mark them absent the rest of the year." "But what about their parents?" asked Miss Caroline. "Ain't got no mother," was the answer, and their pa's right contentious. Burris Ewell was flattered by the recital. "Been coming to the first day since the first grade for 3 years now," he said expansively. "Reckon if I'm smart this year, they'll promote me to the second." Miss Caroline said, "Sit back down, please, Burris." And the moment she said it, I knew she had made a serious mistake. The boy's condescension flashed to anger. "You try and make me, missus." Little Chuck Little got to his feet. Let him go, ma'am, he said. He's a mean one, a hard-down mean one. He's liable to start something, and there's some little folks here. He was among the most diminutive of men, but when Burris Uwell turned toward him, little Chuck's right hand went to his pocket. Watch your step, Burris, he said. I'd sooner kill you than look at you. Now go home. Burris seemed to be afraid of a child half his height, and Miss Caroline took advantage of his indecision. Burris, go home. If you don't, I'll call the principal, she said. I'll have to report this anyway. The boy snorted and slouched leisurely to the door. Safely out of range, he turned and shouted, Report and be damned to you! Ain't no snot, no slut of a schoolteacher ever born gonna make me do nothing! You ain't making me go nowhere, missus! You just remember that! You ain't making me go nowhere! He waited until he was sure she was crying, then he shuffled out of the building. Soon we were clustered around her desk, trying in our various ways to comfort her. He was a real mean one, below the belt. You ain't called on to teach folks like that. Them ain't Maycomb's ways. Miss Caroline, not really. Now, don't you fret, Miss Caroline. Why don't you read us a story? That cat thing was real fine this morning. Miss Caroline smiled, blew her nose, and said, Thank you, darlings. Dispersed us, opened a book, and mystified the first grade with a long narrative about a toad frog that lived in a hall. When I passed the Radley place for the fourth time that day, twice at full gallop, my gloom had deepened to match the house. As if the remainder of the school year were as fraught with drama as the first day, perhaps it would be mildly entertaining, but the prospect of spending 9 months refraining from reading and writing made me think of running away. By late afternoon, most of my traveling plans were complete. When Jim and I raced each other up the sidewalk to meet Atticus coming home from work, I didn't give him much of a race. It was our habit to run meet Atticus the moment we saw him around the post office corner in the distance. Atticus seemed to have forgotten my noontime fall from grace. He was full of questions about school. My replies were monosyllabic, and he did not press me. Perhaps Calpurnia sensed that my day had been a grim one. She let me watch her fix supper. Shut your eyes and open your mouth, and I'll give you a surprise, she said. It was not often that she made crackling bread. She said she never had time, but with both of us at school today, had been an easy one for her. She knew I loved crackling bread. I missed you today, she said. The house got so lonesome long about 2 o'clock, I had to turn on the radio. Why? Jim and me ain't ever in the house until it's raining. I know, she said, but one of you is always calling in the distance. I wonder how much of the day I spend just calling after you. Well, she said, getting up from the kitchen chair, it's enough time to make a pan of crackling bread, I reckon. You run along now and let me get supper on the table. Calpurnia bent down and kissed me. I ran along, wondering what had come over her. She had wanted to make up with me, was that it? She had always been too hard on me. She had at last seen the error of her fractious ways. She was sorry and too stubborn to say so. I was weary from the day's crimes. After supper, Atticus sat down with the paper and called. Scout, ready to read? The Lord sent me more than I could bear, and I went to the front porch. Atticus followed me. Something wrong, Scout? I told Atticus I didn't feel very well and didn't think I'd go to school anymore if it was all right with him. Atticus sat down in the swing and crossed his legs. His fingers wandered to his watch pocket. He said that was the only way he could think. He waited in amiable silence, and I sought to reinforce my position. You never went to school, and you do all right, so I'll just stay home, too. You can teach me like Granddaddy taught you and Uncle Jack. No, I can't, said Atticus. I have to make a living. Besides, they'd put me in jail if I kept you at home. Dose of magnesia for you tonight and school tomorrow. I'm feeling all right, really. I thought so. Now, what's the matter? Bit by bit, I told him of the day's misfortunes. And she said you taught me all wrong, so we can't ever read any more, ever. Please don't send me back, please, sir. Atticus stood up and walked to the end of the porch. When he completed his examination of the wisteria vine, he strolled back to me. First of all, he said, if you can learn a simple trick, Scout, you'll get along a lot better with all kinds of folks. You never really understood a person until you consider things from his point of view. Sir? Until you climb into his skin and walk around in it. Atticus said I had learned many things today, and Miss Caroline had learned several things herself. She had learned not to hand something to a Cunningham, for one thing. But if Walter and I had put ourselves in her shoes, we'd have seen it was an honest mistake on her part. We could not expect her to learn all Maycomb's ways in one day, and we could not hold her responsible when she knew no better. I'll be dogged, I said. I didn't know no better than not to read to her, and she held me responsible. Listen, Atticus, I don't have to go to school. I was bursting with a sudden thought. Burrus Ewell, remember? He just goes to school the first day. The truant lady reckons she's carried out the law when she gets his name on the roll. You can't do that, Scout, Atticus said. Sometimes it's better to bend the law a little in special cases. In your case, the law remains rigid, so to school you must go. I don't see why I have to when he doesn't. Then listen. Atticus said the Ewalds had been the disgrace of Maycomb for 3 generations. None of them had done an honest day's work in his recollection. He said that some Christmas, when he was getting rid of the tree, he would take me with him and show me where and how they lived. They were people, but they lived like animals. They can go to school any time they want to when they show the faintest symptom of wanting an education, said Atticus. There are ways of keeping them in school by force, but it's silly to force people like the Ewalds into a new environment. If I didn't go to school tomorrow, you'd force me to. Let us leave it at this, said Atticus dryly. You, Miss Scout Finch, are of the common folk. You must obey the law. He said that the Ewalds were members of an exclusive society made up of Ewalds. In certain circumstances, the common folk judiciously allowed them certain privileges by the simple method of becoming blind to some of the Ewalds' activities. They didn't have to go to school, for one thing. Another thing, Mr. Bob Ewell Burris's father was permitted to hunt and trap out of season. Atticus, that's bad, I said. In Maycomb County, hunting out of season was a misdemeanor at law, a capital felony in the eyes of the populace. It's against the law, all right, said my father, and it's certainly bad, but when a man spends his relief checks on green whiskey, his children have a way of crying from hunger pains. I don't know of any landowner around here who begrudges those children any game their father can hit. Mr. Ewell shouldn't do that. Of course he shouldn't, but he'll never change his ways. Are you going to take out your disapproval on his children? No, sir, I murmured, and made a final stand. But if I keep on going to school, we can't ever read anymore. That's really bothering you, isn't it? Yes, sir. When Atticus looked down at me, I saw the expression on his face that always made me expect something. Do you know what a compromise is? He asked. Bending the law? No. An agreement reached by mutual concessions. It works this way. If you'll concede the necessity of going to school, we'll go on reading every night just as we always have. Is it a bargain? Yes, sir. We'll consider it sealed without the usual formality, Atticus said when he saw me preparing to spit. As I opened the front door screen door, Atticus said, By the way, Scout, you better not say anything at school about our agreement. Why not? I'm afraid our activities would be received with considerable disapprobation by the more learned authorities. Jen and I were accustomed to our father's last will and testament dictation, and we were at all times free to interrupt Atticus for a translation when it was beyond our understanding. Huh, sir? I never went to school, he said, but I have a feeling that if you tell Miss Caroline we read every night, she'll get after me, and I wouldn't want her after me. Atticus kept us in fits that evening, gravely reading columns of print about a man who sat on a flagpole for no discernible reason, which was reason enough for Jim to spend the following Saturday aloft in the treehouse. Jim sat from after breakfast until sunset and would have remained overnight had not Atticus severed his supply lines. I had spent most of the day climbing up and down, running errands for him, providing him with literature, nourishment, and water, and was carrying him blankets for the night when Atticus said if I paid no attention to him, Jim would come down. Atticus was right. Thanks for listening to Chapters 2 and 3. Be sure to hit that subscribe button below, which helps me make more of these audiobooks. Coming up next, Chapter 4.